Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I'm so excited about this edition because I've got one of South Africa's most articulate and active industrial entrepreneurs as my guest, and we're going to be talking about mining, the energy transition, industrial policy, beneficiation, and what the new government needs to do to grow industry, and also strawberries. Vuslot Bayulu is the co-founder and managing director of the mining investment company, MENA, which has controlling stakes in Canyon Coal, Zululand, Anthracite Colliery, Kangra and East Manganese. He holds an honors degree in mechanical engineering, got 20 years of mining experience in the mining industry. And during that period, he's grown a company from a little one to quite a really big one. Bayulu is a hands-on investor and actively involved in debates, both private and often very public, on social media and in the mainstream media, where I try to read everything he writes. And while I might not always agree, it's hard not to be blown away by the passion he brings to the things that he says about our industries, and with a keen interest in bettering the South African economy. He's actively involved in seeking solutions to key issues faced by the country. He serves on the board of the Richards Bay Coal Terminal and recently became a director on the board of the World Coal Association, which I think is now called Future Coal. It's a good time to talk because this government either now gets industrial and mining and energy policy right, or it leaves us scrambling and behind the pack for decades. And Vuslot Bayulu, I was thrilled to read recently that one of our mothball smelters, the old Metalloy smelter at Meyerton, south of Johannesburg, is going to reopen. And it turns out you're one of the big investors behind it. Can you tell us about it?
Thank you, Peter, for hosting me. Metalloy's is owned by Samancor, and we made a deal with them. And we are busy with the Comcom application, and later on we will apply for the licenses to be ceded to us. We're hoping to finalize the deal by end of this year. It's an exciting project for us because it was the largest ferromanganese smelter in the world with four furnaces. And because of the high power prices and unavailability of power in South Africa, and also this plant was a bit old, they decided to stop operating. And we saw it as an opportunity because it has got the full infrastructure, it has got all the licenses in place, except they are in the process of getting a new water use license. But they have the infrastructure to get manganese from Northern Cape, which is a great advantage, and also skills in that area, in Johannesburg as well, like all the skills regarding smelting. That made us like think about, okay, look, we can do this. We can restart this whole thing, but maybe with a different technology, which requires less power and more coke, that could actually reduce the oxygen in the manganese ore. So that's why we showed interest, and we did a due diligence, and we eventually did the deal. So we are happy, and we are excited to restart this project. Once we own it, then we're going to start actually making the right moves in terms of like bringing it back into production.
Vuslot, just explain to me and to people who listen who aren't mechanical engineers or don't know what manganese does or why we need to smelt it and what happens to it. What is, you know, my questions are, first of all, what do you use the manganese for? Why do we need it? How valuable is it? And can it be smelted, and can it be reduced to products that are profitable to buy and sell?
So manganese is used in steel making, mostly. That's the widest application, it enhances steel's different properties, and steel industry can use it in the form of ferromanganese. So manganese ore cannot be used in the steel as is. It has to be ferromanganese, which means like the manganese ore that we mine in South Africa, it changes between the manganese content changes between 30% and 45 to 46%. When you do a ferroalloy, then you increase that manganese percentage by burning the unwanted I wanted, let's say, impurities. Hence, you increase the manganese content to 75 to 80%. And that is used then in the steel industry. So what matte alloys, or the name is going to be Quellamet, is going to do is it's going to smelt the manganese ore that's mined in Northern Cape, and then make the product available for the steel industry in different parts of the world, be it Europe, be it United States, or be it China. But generally, South African alloys goes to Europe and United States because China has got a massive capacity to make ferroalloys. And you also you must remember or you must know that South Africa is the largest manganese producer in the world, and we've got the largest ore deposits in the world. The second largest is actually Gabon, then Brazil and Australia are producers. But South Africa is going to be at some point only one of the two producers in the world with Gabon, because Australia is finishing their resources. Hence, manganese is a critical mineral for South Africa. And what our furnaces will do, future furnaces will do, is it will beneficiate, so it will create jobs in South Africa, it will create procurement opportunities in South Africa, and it will sell the ferroalloy to the steel industry in different parts of the
and
world.
And just explain to me, so your customers are steel makers, basically, right? Right.
Right.
And it's fundamentally an export industry. What has been happening to South African manganese in the absence of the smelter, it's been mothballed, because it's been mothballed for quite a long time? What has happened to the ore? Where has it gone? Yeah. What have we been doing with it?
So South Africa has another smelter that's in Cato Ridge, which is owned by Assmang. That's Arm and Sako family joint venture. They carry on smelting. They make ferroalloy there in terms of ferromanganese. Balance of the product that's mined in Northern Cape is exported through Port Elizabeth or Saldanha. And it's then like generally 36.5 to 37% manganese content. Mostly it goes to China and it becomes a ferroalloy there, and it goes into that massive steel industry in China that makes the steel. So we are moving about 16 million tons as South African manganese miners to China mostly. Some goes to India as well, but mostly it goes to China in the raw form. So very few quantity is smelted.
So basically, we're digging up rocks, putting them on ships, and sending them off to other people who can smelt the ore. And between yourself now and Assmang in KZN, we'll be able to beneficiate, i.e., process more of the ore than we've been able to. Wuslat, do the people when you beneficiate something to the extent that you're going to, you're changing the product that you're producing? Do you also need to then change the client? Does the receiver of the rocks, let's say, that we've been sending to China, are they the same people who you would then sell a more pure product to, or do you have to find new customers?
Actually, customers completely change. Instead of Chinese buyers, then your product goes to United States or Europe, to the steelmakers. Because China is buying most of our manganese and they're making the alloys in China and they use it in the steel industry. So customer base completely changes.
So you know, because the whole debate about beneficiation in South Africa, and I'm sure you know all about this more than I do, it's something that just gets repeated and repeated every time there's a new government or every time there's a policy conference. The ANC, particularly because it's been the government for the past 30 years, will come out and say we need to beneficiate more of our minerals. And I just wonder to what extent we already do beneficiate our minerals and whether the constant calling for beneficiation is helpful. I mean, I understand now where you're able to, you know, able to buy a ready-made, as you say, the smelter is there. It can do all of the things you want it to do. Is there lots more room to beneficiate in South Africa? And if there is, what minerals can we beneficiate more, and what are the routes to the customer that we would have to change in order for that new product to make us some money?
Okay, I think like obviously in business, when you mine something in mining business, you try to get the best out of it. Like, and if you look at like if I can beneficiate further, if I can get more money, if I can make more profit, then you will obviously look at that option. But it's not that easy. Like when somebody tells you, okay, look, we need to beneficiate our minerals more, otherwise we'll put taxes on it and all those kind of things. It doesn't really work like that, because you need to look at each and every commodity and see like what we are doing. Like in terms of, for instance, chrome, we've got ferrochrome smelters in South Africa that are idling at the moment because they don't have power. Or the power is very expensive compared to like a power supply coming from hydroelectric hydroelectric plants. So it's like when you say something for populist reasons, it's very easy to say. But when it comes to the details, it becomes a different story. Like if you look at PGMs, we've got PGM smelters. But then do we have catalytic converter industry in South Africa? We don't. So catalytic converters are done in different parts of the world. That's for combustion engines. So you to create the industry, the manufacturing industry, that's going to support what you're mining is a different ball game. And to give you an idea, if you look at China, for instance, they are the largest solar panel manufacturer in the world. 80% of the solar panels are made in China. So I remember like when Barbara Creasy was the Minister of Department of Environmental Affairs, they were going out and saying, look, we're going to close Komati Power Station, but we're going to create a massive like solar and windmill manufacturing capacity in Witbank. Well, what happened to that? Nothing, right? Because it was nothing. Like I don't want to say it was a lie. Yeah. But it was a lie.
No, but
it was not true because it was misleading the people. So you can say a lot of things like we're not beneficiating enough and all those kind of things. But we need to look at the industries. Like we talk about iron ore, for instance. People say, why are we not beneficiating our iron ore more? Like South Africa exports about 40 to 50 million tons of iron ore. Do you know how much China makes a year in steel? 1 billion tons.
Yeah.
Say one company, BHP Billiton, moves like 300 million tons of iron ore from Australia to China at a very competitive price. Rio Tinto moves about 250 million tons. Vale moves 250 million tons. So our 50 million tons is almost nothing. And to beneficiate iron ore further in South Africa, we got Mittal, which is old ISCOR. They are beneficiating, but the issue is there is not enough demand in South Africa. You need to have construction industry. You need to have infrastructure projects. So where do you sell your steel? Because you cannot compete with Chinese steel. You cannot compete with the steel that's made in Pakistan or Turkey. So you need to look at these things if it's viable. So I think when it comes to beneficiation, one has to look at each and every commodity, each and every mineral. What else can we do? Like coal. We beneficiate it to make power.
We burn it.
What else can you do? Yes, you can make fertilizer.
Yeah.
We burn it. But Sasol makes even further. Sasol makes fuel out of it. That's the like one of the few companies in the world that has got that capacity. And it's a like flagship company for South Africa that's doing great. Because we need that. We need build jobs. We need Sasol to be a successful company so that it supports the coal mining industry and it also produces the fuel that we consume. So beneficiation thing is like I said, you need to look at product or mineral specific.
So we would, for instance, go back to PGM, Platinum Group Metals. We presumably don't, I know that we pelletize, we have the capacity to make platinum pellets out of the ores that we mine, and apparently we fly the pellets out to Germany where they put into catalytic converters or whatever it might, and we then import the cars back here. Is there a policy discussion if you had control? Is there a policy discussion that you would want to have with the government about how they approach all of this? I know that you recently wrote in Business Day a piece about what Gwede Mantashe could do to to move the economy along. And you were hopeful that he might be able to. But, even you had five things that you wanted him to do. One was which was to sort out local government, which is impossible for the Minister of Mining, Minerals and to do. But it's impossible for anyone to do because it's utterly broken. But if there are there, what are the quick wins, Vuslat, in your mind for South Africa in terms of industrial policy, mining and industrial policy? It's all one kind of thing. If there were more mines, we'd have more companies servicing the mines, presumably. We might even make some machines that the mines could use, as we used to do.
Definitely. Look, first of all, if you look at manganese mining, let's look at manganese, or let's look at chrome. Chrome is made out of chrome mining, or also chrome made as out of PGM mining, because there's a seam called UG2, and then if you mine that, you get a lot of product as chrome. So that is actually in fine form, and then China loves it, and then they use it in their making ferrochrome, and then again using it in their steel industry. So there is a limit for these kind of things. Like, you can't just say that I want to create more mines and I'm going to sell it to China.
Yeah.
Why? Because if China needs, let's say, 20 million tons of chrome, I'm just putting an arbitrary number, then if you produce 2 million tons, then the price will go down. So that's critical to make sure that you have the balance as the country, not to actually make sure that the prices don't go down, because every ton of manganese or coal or chrome or platinum group metals or gold that we sell means our GDP, because we're talking about like 425 billion rand GDP that mining actually contributes to our overall GDP. So that's one important thing. And the other thing is, I think consultation with the industry is critical for the minister. Minister is very pro-mining, even though people have got a different perception about him. But I know him. And I know that he is actually very pro-mining guy. He will support if there's a good idea. So I think for him to understand the industry better, that's what I was mentioning in my opinion piece in Sunday Times, no, Business Day, sorry, that he must consult with wider groups in the mining industry to understand what are the problems with the chrome, coal, manganese, iron ore, PGMs, gold. What are the issues? And by the way, we've got very similar issues. If you look at the bulk commodities, our biggest issue is Transnet.
Yeah.
Be it rail, be it port. If you don't fix it, you cannot do anything. I've been in mining for 20 years in South Africa. I've never had an issue with the DMRE, except the minister during, I forgot the name now, Mosebenzi Zwane.
Yeah.
Except him, actually, he got one of our mines. He rewalked the mining, right? And we ended up going to court. Luckily, the legal system works in this country. We made an urgent application and we ran the mine until we closed it with a court order. When the DMR people come to the mine, we were showing them the court order. So, in general, getting mining rights, getting environmental approvals, getting SLPs approved, these things are working. Yes, it can improve, but the issue is, the main issue for mining companies is bulk commodities, Transnet, and in general it's the availability of power and power price, because when the power price goes up, industries start moving. So for instance, Assmang built a power a ferromanganese plant in Malaysia. Why? Because they were worried about the availability of power and the price of power, and they were right. Because, if you don't have power available, if you use electric arc furnace technology, you can't make it in South Africa. You need to go to a country like Malaysia, which offers you very cheap hydroelectric power. So it starts with power. Everything starts with power. And if, let's say, Guadamantashe has another round of consultation with the mining industry players, then they will all tell him, listen, we need power. Otherwise, we can't beneficiate. We need supply. We need power so that we can actually do that. Look at Bayside, which was owned by SAR32 Aluminium Smelter. They closed it down. Why? because they need power. Again, they need cheap power because aluminium is very competitive, and you are competing with China, with Russia, so you have to have very cheap power. So when we are talking about this, like, it's all interlinked, and if you don't sort the power issue, then you can't actually talk about beneficiation. You can't talk about any policy.
Yeah, just come back to the smelter you're buying in Meyerton, then south of Joburg, because as I understand it, you were saying you're using a new technology. They currently use an electric arc furnace, if I'm not mistaken. So you basically melt the manganese out of the ore. You're going to replace the electric arc furnace with a more traditional coal-fired furnace. And I was wondering whether you mightn't be rethinking that now, because Eskom seems to have more power suddenly than it knows what to do with. It's done very well to get its energy availability factor back up to, you know, beyond 70%. We all know how well we're doing. How does that affect you running a business now? You made a big decision. I'm sure putting in a new furnace is no small thing. Does what Eskom is doing give you reason to pause and think again?
So, electric arc furnace needs power, and that's one of the reasons why we don't want to use it. So blast furnace needs less power, much less power, and then you need to use more coke, which is made out of coking coal. So it makes the process less efficient. We're going to be exposed to coke prices, which is paid in dollars, and we don't have really a lot of coke capacity in South Africa. We need to most probably buy it from China or India, wherever it's made, or Mozambique. But we will then rely on coke. And there's another alternative that we might. One of the majors actually came up with the idea. They say that we can use the existing two last furnaces that was built, but then they want to put a unit which will pelletize the fines, and then we will feed the pelletized fines to the furnace. That would actually require less power. Actually, it will require one-third of what electric arc furnace will require. So we are actually using this time until this deal is closed. We are trying to find out what is the best solution. But one thing that I'm sure is, because we are mining manganese in this country, we got lots of manganese, and if let's say old metalloys can use another million ton of manganese, that means another like 6-7% more manganese to be mined in the country and then beneficiated. That's for sure, like, we have to do it. But then with which technology, we need to determine that. But I don't think it's going to be electric arc furnaces, because maybe we'll talk about it. But Eskom's current problems are sorted. But I want to know, like, how are we going to solve the future problems? Because, yes, now electricity availability factor is 70%, which is way above than 65% what NERSA put as a target. But when Grootvlei, Camden, Arnott, Hendrina start completely failing, then what is the solution?
Yeah.
So because of that, you cannot actually run an electric arc furnace in ferromanganese, but you rather run a blast furnace or a new technology that would require less power.
Let's talk about energy some more. You're chairman of Future Coal, the World Coal Association. You may have seen an article recently by a former colleague of mine, actually, a guy called Javier Blas, on Bloomberg, in which he argues that whatever greenies like myself may want to hear, the fact is that the world today is using more coal than ever. And I presume that gives you some comfort.
I think when it comes to these kind of discussions, we just need to talk about the facts, because a lot of people talk with their, like, wish list, but the wish list doesn't work. 150,000 megawatts in Germany, wind and solar capacity without Russian gas means nothing, literally. That's why all the chemical companies in Germany are trying to move to Poland, because of the unavailability of power and the price of power. And I think they realized, I'm speaking to my German friends, they realize that it's a problem for the country because it's such an industrial giant, manufacturing giant, and then they don't have enough power, and then they've got expensive power. So, I mean, I just want to give you some statistics. China has got 1,142 coal-fired power stations. India has 282. United States has 210. We got 15 in South Africa. And the whole world is interested in closing the coal-fired power stations in South Africa. And this country saw a minister and a former CEO of Eskom celebrating the closure of a 1,000-megawatt coal-fired power station. At the same time, they were negotiating to buy power from a floating vessel in Richards Bay and in Durban. And it's awkward to me because, I mean, why did we close Kawati Power Station? And then we were trying to buy power from car power ships.
Well, I think, if to be fair, there was only one unit left working at Kamati when it was closed. And I think what had happened was that the World Bank had lent us quite a large amount of money on the promise that we would close Kamati. So you either take the money or that. But I mean, I hear what you're saying. The war of statistics is a terrible thing because everybody's got their own, you know. So the China, as you say, has got, you know, thousands of power stations. It's also building 350 gigawatts of solar and wind power. Just huge at an incredible rate. That's seven ESCOMs, you know. The world is adding a megawatt of solar and wind every 2 days. So can we at least agree on the thing that you know, while the use of coal is growing, the coming energy source is obviously going to be renewable. I mean, it's just, you know, the speed of it is immeasurable almost at the moment. It's not to say, obviously, that the two don't go hand in hand. You can't walk away from coal-fired power in South Africa because you wouldn't have an economy. But eventually, and you might even find ways, artificial intelligence will help you, find ways of, you know, of extracting or purifying the ores that you produce as a mining company. I've got no real point to make on it. The point, I suppose, is what is the government supposed to do? What should it be doing? What should our policy look like? Do you do both?
I think coal and renewable energy goes hand in hand because renewable energy is complementary to base load, which is critical. And when the humanity finds out a better way of storing the energy, and it will happen at some point, it's not there yet, it's very expensive, it's not physically viable, but when the humanity finds that the power that's produced during the day because of the solar radiation to be stored in a very practical way and cheap way, then the base load capacity will be less. It will still be there. I think specifically, if you think about South Africa, again, I earlier said, my question and my concern is, what happens when the coal-fired power stations, the old ones, come to a real end of their lives? What happens? Do we refurbish them? Can they be refurbished? Or what do you want us to do? Like, because we are listening to the world and their world is giving us ideas. They're saying, no, you must burn gas. Okay, let's burn gas. Where do we get the gas from? We don't have gas in South Africa. Now, people are going to say, no, we found gas in Mossel Bay, outside Cape Town. But where is it? Can we really extract it commercially? No. So what do we do until we extract gas commercially? Do we want to dollarize our power by buying gas from Mozambique or Tanzania or Algeria or Saudi Arabia or UAE or Qatar, wherever we buy the gas? Do we want that? Which is very dangerous because high power price means high inflation. So we are still lucky Eskom is not expensive. It's expensive compared to the previous years, but it's still very competitive if you look at the world power prices. So what I want to know, actually, which I don't have this answer, we don't have enough gas coming from Mozambique to Sasol. That's why Sasol said they will not give enough gas. They will not give gas to the industry, which means industry must pay four times more if they buy gas, which was brought in LNG form to Maputo or Beira, wherever, and then brought through a pipeline to Gauteng, which is not going to work. So what is the solution? If you are thinking that you're going to do renewables plus gas, where is the gas going to come from? At what price gas is going to come from? Because coal mining industry employs 100,000 people. Just the mining industry. Okay, now, if you go to gas, that means that you are getting gas from another country that's employing people in another place. So does it make sense to do that? Or is it better to mine in South Africa, pay in rents, create jobs and procurement opportunities for South Africans, but burn the coal with the clean coal technologies, which is available? That's what China does. These 1,100 power stations, most of them have got the clean coal technologies that when they're burning the coal, they minimize the emissions. Especially the new ones, they are all like they're all obligatory. They need to do they need to apply the clean coal technologies. Why don't we talk about that? Because there's a good initiative actually at Calvin Power Station. They call it Coal CO2X program. They showed it to the Minister of Environmental Affairs, and I think the Chair Minister was there as well. They minimize the emissions. Because we got a power station in the middle of Joburg in Kempton Park that has got the capacity of 400 megawatt. That's critical for the grid in Johannesburg, in Gauteng. And we need to make sure that they carry on, because the impact is already there. Environmental impact is already there. That's what I don't understand, like when it comes to these coal-fired power stations to be stopped, because the impact is there. When you build a new gas-fired power station, you're gonna make a new impact in the environment. So how can we benefit from the existing fleet first? And then what are we going to do when the existing fleet come to a stage where they need to be demolished?
So because the current plan then is to replace some of this capacity with gas-fired capacity, convert the peaking power stations to gas. And I think there's a plan to build a gas power plant near, is it near Richards Bay, Vosloorus? I'm not sure, somewhere in KwaZulu,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what you're arguing is that that makes no sense, because you've got to buy gas in dollars and you've got to transport it in from overseas. You've got to build a whole new infrastructure to transport it. Can I just ask you, the gas users in Gauteng, including Sasol, their technologies are basically, these are gas-run businesses, I'm sure. The glass companies, et cetera, et cetera. What could a coal-fired power station do to help them?
They can actually change their boilers to burn coal. That's possible.
Yeah.
But obviously it's an expense, it's a capital expense.
Absolutely.
But that is possible. That can happen.
Yeah. So what you have then, and I agree with you about gas, by the way. I'd much rather get some use out of coal while we can. But then what is our route into the future look like? So we leave the gas option aside, which Gwede Mantashe won't be happy about. He wants gas by all accounts. And he makes a lot of arguments for gas, and there's a lot of discussion going on, I'm sure, as you know, about gas and whether how much infrastructure, whether there is or whether there isn't a case for it. But do we then have a situation where it's basically coal and renewables and maybe some nuclear? We've already got little nuclear at in the Cape, and there's talk about and more nuclear capacity, depending on how we find the money to finance it. Can you get funding? Will the banks lend money to build new coal capacity? I'm sure that'd be really difficult.
So, look, there are different ways of doing these things, but I give this example. Like if you go to Saudi Arabia today and say, look, you're like making 10 million barrels a day and you should stop this because this is causing environmental issues. 10 million barrels a day and they cost us about $5 a barrel and they're selling it at $85 a barrel. What will they tell you? They will tell you like to disappear because it's their bread and butter. So every country has its own position. And I mean, if you look at Saudi Arabia, they're one of the biggest investors in solar capacity they want to build in their desert. So government needs to put their stance. We have coal, We have to burn coal. We have to burn coal in a, with clean coal technologies. Unless there is gas in this country, unless they show to the country that if you burn gas, it's going to be cheaper. Because think about the hype with regards to the renewable energy programs. Actually, people criticized Guedes Mantashe, but during his period, a lot of renewable energy projects were granted. And we've got the capacity in Northern Cape, and we don't have the grid. So when these projects were started, what did these people think about? That Eskom is going to spend 350 billion rand to bring that power to Gauteng, which is 6 hours a day. What happens 18 hours a day? Eskom doesn't have that kind of money. So again, there's a hype about, oh, we're going to do gas. Where are you going to get the gas? At what price are you going to get the gas? What is the cost of that gas burned power?
Just on the renewable stuff, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not sure why the people who bid on renewables projects didn't know there was no transmission for them. Maybe they weren't told. Maybe they were led to believe that there would be investment. It was always going to be an investment made by Eskom, as far as I know. And you know, to be fair to Guedes Mantashe's critics, he may have allowed a lot more renewable projects during his time, but very few have come to fruition. I think he brought on maybe 150 megawatts, which is not a big deal. And there's a long way to go with that stuff, you know. And also, Eskom is now trying to, going to, or threatening to crowd out the private sector, because it's saying, no, we're going to use our plants now, or our land, to put wind turbines on, or solar panels. Well, what the hell do you say that? Because they are really close to the grid. They're beautifully positioned for the grid. Why would you, you know, why would the government allow that sort of behavior to go on? Eskom, if it's going to invest in solar technologies or new technologies, rather spend the money on building a decent grid. But the, your point about gas, I truly take. We just need to decide what the next 10 years looks like. And the problem is, I'm sure for you, I'm a journalist, you're an actual real-life investor, it's your money on the table here, is getting a decision out of the government. It's very difficult because there are so many competing interests that it's trying to solve, and its own ideological ones, which is that the state needs to lead everything. You know, it's very uncomfortable. I know it's doing it, but it's not its natural choice to allow the private sector to do what it should be doing and what it's best at.
I agree with you. I think the challenge is decision making at the moment, and we've been having the challenge for a while, like last 4 or 5 years. If you don't make any decision, nobody is going to help you. So in terms of energy, yeah, like there are different groups. Like one group says, now we need to do only renewable energy, and then that's going to solve the problem, which we saw that it is not the the truth. The other group says, no, we have to do nuclear because most probably they are in nuclear business and then they want to invest in South Africa. And then the other group says, no, we're going to solve it with gas. There will be a lot of money that's going to the infrastructure, so they will be maybe getting those tenders. They want to get those tenders. But government needs to think about, okay, what is right for my people? There are people who are really poor in this country. We need to create jobs for them. How do you create jobs? People in Sandton work in the restaurants. They can't work there because they were not, actually, 4 months ago, because of load shedding, because restaurants were not operating properly, because they didn't have power. So this is the simple thing that government should do, give power. So one person is changed, the whole thing is changed. Now Eskom is fixed. It's like I give the example of the rugby team of South Africa. The coach made a really, truly South African team. Everybody is interested in watching it. So we need to think about what is right for this country. What is right for me, this is what I see. We need to have coal, definitely, because it employs South Africans. We need nuclear and we need renewable energy. But I doubt, and I don't understand, somebody needs to explain it to me, the logic of, like, talking about gas, where are you going to get gas, at what price you're going to get gas, and how much are we going to pay for that price? If you don't explain to me, then it's going to be the same discussion like renewable energy. Like, And also, add what I was going to say. I think private-public partnership is critical because I saw a company in Russia, for instance, they actually bought the old state-owned Russian coal-fired power stations and they ran it successfully. So sometimes when state fails, private companies can play a role. But then they need to allow companies to build, the companies to invest, and then companies to be able to sell. So they need to deregulate the power market so that it is open to the private sector. Then they will be the referee. With the NERSA, they determine the price so that people are not overcharged. So every state does that. Then in this situation, state plays the role. Okay, we're gonna do gas, but we know what happened at Kusile. We know what happened at Medupi. How did you build those power stations? How long did it take? How much did it cost? The companies now that are trying to do renewable energy projects, some of them were part of those power stations, which took 10 years and it didn't finish at the right budget. It was overrun budget. So I think we need to find out what is right for the country and we need to make that decision, then people will help.
Yeah. No, I'm sure.
Otherwise, if you are still all over,
yeah,
sure, it's yeah, not going to help.
I'm sure you're right about gas, but you know the point that you're making about allowing the private sector to supply the power that it can would also apply to mining. I mean, you know, this is where I'm sorry, you know, I disagree about you. I think you were too kind to Gwede Mantashe in your piece in Business Day. He is a block on mining. He, nothing happens where Gwede doesn't want it to happen. There should be more investment in mining. I'm not saying there should be more mines, although I think there probably should. We haven't sunk a shaft in South Africa for a decade, you know, and we're the biggest mining resource in the world. And it's like Venezuela, you know, Venezuela is the biggest, sitting on more oil than anybody else, but it can't do anything with it. Why are we not making, you know, it's not as if you don't collapse the world market simply by supplying into it. Miners can play the market as well, I'm sure. The problem here is we cannot make, we have strategies and we get distracted from them. We had a strategy at one stage. We got 8.5 billion dollars from, you know, Europe and America for the just energy transition. And then suddenly we put our hand up and said, oh, wait a bit. No, we have to slow down. It's all going too fast. But we've already got the money. Thank you very much. We just won't, you know, do our part of the deal. What is the magic thing here for the state? What would get the government to calm down and make rational decisions that would help it get richer, you know, help? I mean, it's surely one can see that the more wealthy South Africa is, the safer the government is. And they seem not to appreciate that. Everything is about perception.
I agree with you. I agree with you, including my view about Mantashe. Yeah. I agree with you on that one as well.
Yeah.
So look, it starts with exploration. I mean, if you look at what South Africa is attracting, it's like, it's a shame for South Africa. We've got massive potential, but companies are not coming here. They go to DRC, they go to Zambia, they go to Namibia, Botswana, but they don't come here. And there's a reason for that. I think Minister and his team need to question this. And they say, okay, why? Why are we not attracting people? And they obviously strong unions and the community issues is a big problem for mining companies when they see what's happening in the existing operations. I mean, a big question, let's ask ourselves, like BHP wants to buy Anglo, but they say we don't want to get involved in South Africa.
Too messy.
It's a terrible thing. I mean, I feel bad like about this. Why? Why do you not want to be the largest platinum producer in the world? Because they're only interested in the South American assets, which is copper. So I think all these things, it's like, it's easy to criticize BHP saying, oh, you can't do this, South Africa is great, this and that. But why is BHP's management thinking like this? Like, let's think about it. Like, it's like we need to get into a room and say, okay, guys, let's talk about this thing. But then, you know, it's one of the things that I mentioned in my piece in Business Day. Like, when minister talks to Minerals Council, he thinks that he spoke to the industry. He didn't speak to the industry. I'm not part of Minerals Council. Because Minerals Council talks about the issues of Anglo, not about me.
No, you make an important point, because this is the problem with business and the government. And it happens in industrial policy too. When Ibrahim Patel was running industrial policy and his policy of localization and a bit of protectionism, tariff protection, it was all for the big companies that he had around him. The middle was missing from Patel's localization. And what you're telling me is that the middle is missing from our mining policies as well. You know, you can talk to Anglo, you can talk to... We simply don't appreciate, or the government doesn't appreciate, how things get made and who makes them, how hard it is already to make a window, let alone, something more complicated. And it doesn't help people like that. It just does these big agreements with big industries as if they should work. And it sounds to me that you feel the same way.
Look, I just want to add something on that one. I know your views about protectionism, but when I came to South Africa in 2001, there was textile industry in Cape Town. There's nothing now. It's finished completely. And it's purely because of government not doing the right things for those industries. I mean, to give you an example, if you look at what Turkey did to Chinese products coming to Turkey, they put 70% tariff, but only textile products. Why? Because it's employing like millions of people. So you cannot actually create jobs, you cannot create employment if you don't have a balanced view on like what you need to do for your people. Yes, Chinese goods come at a very cheap price to South Africa, but what about our people to be employed? Can we really employ people by like doing some protectionism on certain goods? I think that's something that one has to think. But obviously mining industry is opposite. We export lots, and we don't want any protectionism in any country. But we know that world needs our manganese. I know I'm conflicted. World needs manganese. World needs platinum. World needs coal. And nobody wants to, like China does from time to time. They put tax on coal coming from certain countries from time to time. But the reality is you need to, I mean, I think it's all about like having people thinking about like what can we do to make sure that we create jobs in this country, be it mining, be it farming, be it defense industry, be it textiles, be it tourism. But we need jobs to be created. Otherwise, we are not really moving forward.
But you've got to be smart about it, surely. I mean, I agree with you, textiles has worked. But, you know, protecting poultry didn't work. It hasn't worked. All you've done is made it more expensive for somebody in deep rural Transkei to have a chicken. You know, the price has gone high. So you've got to sort yourself out. Not everything works. And steel, your industry, is a classic case. All the protection in the world hasn't helped you. So what is the problem with steel? Do we need a steel industry at all? I know this is a heretical question, but there's so much steel floating around on the high seas for sale. Maybe it's just, maybe it's cheaper just to get it and process it here rather than cast it and make it from scratch.
Even if you look at cement, the same thing happens. Like people send cement from Pakistan to South Africa, from China. I mean, cement normally in every country, you produce cement. Like in a country like this, industrialized country, you need to be able to produce your cement and your steel. But you got valid questions.
Yeah. Listen, we've spoken a lot about minerals and mines and other things that we're really good at here. But the other thing that we're really good at in South Africa is farming. We're really good farmers. And we're the second biggest citrus exporter in the world, which is quite something. There's almost nothing we can't grow. Avocados are becoming more and more sought after. You're about to become a strawberry exporter. Tell us very quickly about that. Vusi's Farm.
Vusi's Farm, yes. It's a bit controversial. We called it Vusi's Farm because in one of the mining events, people were struggling to call my name, and then I told them that you can call me Vusi, and then they laughed at it. That's why we called it Vusi. Otherwise, strawberry is actually not for the local market. Look, we started in one of our open-cast operations. We bought a farm, and then it came with like six farmhouses, and then we put a small tunnel there, and we started producing, and then we saw it worked, and then there was tunnels in Carltonville. They were producing roses, but then What happened is like they built 11.5 hectares. The owner of the farm found out that South African men are not that romantic, and he went bankrupt. He couldn't sell his roses. So we bought the farm from liquidation, and then we turned into the gutters to grow strawberries. So we make it in hydroponic environment, so there's no soil involved. We are using cocoa fiber, water, and fertilizer, and vitamins. Currently, we do it 7 tunnels. When the whole farm is producing, we're going to make about 700 tons of strawberries a year. We supply for local market as well, but we actually did our first export a month ago to Middle East. We did to two different countries. But like you said, South African farming industry is world class. We can find anything in the country, skills, equipment, any consumables, plus the skills. Like when we wanted to export the product, people come and say, okay, we got the market in this country, that country. So that helps a lot. So there's room to grow. And by the way, South Africa is not a big exporter in strawberries. We are not even in the ranking of the world. Like the biggest producer is China, I think. United States is the second biggest producer. So we have still a lot to improve in farming. And especially under the tunnels, you don't need massive land as well. You just need the right climate, and you need to have the right tunnel specification so that you don't you control the climate.
Yeah, Vuslat Bayulu, it's been a real privilege talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for the effort you put into this country and for the passion you bring to us. We're going to get you building a battery farm before too long, I hope. But thank you for joining me, and thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Until then, keep safe and bye bye.